I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. From Hurricane Harvey to Ebola to the Oklahoma City bombing, Wade Goodwin has covered it all. The NPR correspondent has worked in radio for almost three decades, delivering the news in his distinctive Texas twang. Today he'll join me in the studio to talk journalism. Later, I'll sit down with a British actor who's preparing for a series of consecutive one-man shows, each portraying an historical figure that you'll likely recognize. I'll ask why he's drawn to playing Margaret Thatcher, Winston Churchill, even Hitler. Finally, we talk sports with Greg Eklund. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Wade Goodwin is a national correspondent for NPR, and he possesses one of those voices that as soon as you hear it, you recognize it. Based in Dallas, Goodwin has covered a range of major stories, from the killing of five police officers in Dallas in 2016 to the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City. He's covered hurricanes, tornadoes, and even great music. He grew up in a Southern tradition of telling good stories and has come to believe that radio is a perfect medium for it. Wade Goodwin is in town for some KCUR events, and what a pleasure it is to welcome him here. Welcome back. So good to have you, Wade.
Good morning, Steve.
Let me ask you about The Voice, which is, as your fans on Twitter have attempted to characterize over the years, it's been described as a Texas timbre, a nonplus draw, and this one, which I really liked, his voice is like warm butter melting over barbecued sweet corn.
Well, I think that was my mother that said that.
Pretty nice. That's pretty descriptive. Which one do you like best?
It's so funny, but, you know, radio is my second career.
That's right.
I was in politics up in New York City during my first career and didn't really start until I was 31. I moved back to Austin, Texas to try to begin my freelance radio career in 1991, and no one ever said a word about my voice until I got into radio, and then they were like, well, of course you went into radio.
Well, warm butter melting over barbecued sweet corn, I'd take that one to the bank if I were you.
Someone had some poetic license there.
How big is an asset is The Voice?
It's
it helps, doesn't it?
It's hard to know how much of a factor it is. I mean, clearly people recognize my voice. I think that helps. But people recognize Ira Glass's voice, which is a completely different voice. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have to have a deep voice to stand out. Silvio Pajoli, a completely different voice. Fantastic. Nina Totenberg. I think what's important is to kind of have your own voice in terms of the way you write for yourself. I think really the writing is just as important, more important in my mind as the voice. But I definitely have a face for radio.
How many times have we both heard that one over the years?
Well, me, you know? Constantly. It's an ever-present critique.
You know, this is interesting. You said a key for you has been that over the years you learned to slow down with your stories and not race to pack as many details into them as much as you once did. Why was that so important for you?
Well, the reason I raced was because I felt like I had so much more to say in the story and I didn't have enough time to say it. So I thought, well, the way to fix that is I'll just read real fast.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to learn that I was just going to have to leave some of that incredibly good tape on the floor and live with that, because slowing down helped the listener stay with me.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that it's hard when you're hearing a story on the radio to keep everything in mind. You can't go back and read the previous paragraph.
That's right.
So slowing down is important to, I think, understanding, having listeners understand what you're trying to tell them.
NPR's Wayne Goodwin is my guest. You once said that when you were younger that you didn't want to be a journalist as much as you wanted to be an NPR reporter. Why was a job at NPR where you wanted to be?
it just felt, I mean, part of it has to do, I wasn't sure necessarily why until I got into it. I just knew that this was a place where I felt reporters had the freedom to report what was in front of them and give a little sense of what they thought about it. And that was important to me. Not that I become some sort of columnist, but that the reporter was able to impart to the listener some sense of what he or she had been witnessing was impacting them, making them think about it. I learned when I got to NPR that, you know, a large part of this just has to do with the funding system. Mm-hmm. We are owned by our listeners, and we are accountable to them, and that gives us enormous freedom. There's no pressure from any other commercial or corporate entity for us to shade things or cover things in a certain way or have your money withdrawn and go someplace else. Mm-hmm. I mean, who would have thought that the enduring funding model was going to be haranguing our poor listeners, you know, twice or three times a year? But that is what has saved public radio, in that we're growing while other newspapers and print organizations are struggling to stay alive.
What was the hardest thing you had to learn, Wade, as you went from history major and political activist, if you will, to journalist at NPR?
Radio reporting is hard. I mean, there's so many elements to it. You have to learn how to interview. You have to learn about sound. You have to learn how to weave your voice in and out of a series of tape cuts so that it becomes some sort of seamless and moving thing. And all of that takes years. I don't think I really learned how to be a decent radio reporter until I was somewhere in my fifth year. Mm-hmm. And I'm still learning about how to do this. It's a real craft. We have some of the most talented newspaper reporters in the country who are out of jobs, who are now coming. They've had years of writing journalism. And it's a real transition to learn how to do it this way.
Whole different way of doing business, right?
Yeah. And you have to go stick your microphone in people's faces. Mm-hmm. And that's different than being on the phone. It takes longer to produce radio stories than it does to produce newspaper stories, because you have to go out into the field.
And that's an advantage, you said this morning, because you get a chance, you got to go to the story, and you learn a lot of things in the process of going to the story.
Sitting across from somebody and interviewing them face to face tells you a lot of things that sitting on the phone and talking to them over the phone just does not. Yeah. It allows you to have your nose, you know, if there's something a little off, to be able to see that person while they're talking to you, that can be an early warning sign that, I'm not sure this guy or this gal is telling me the truth here. I'm going to follow up on this. Mm-hmm. You know, and that just little bit of something that makes you feel inside like, that's a little hinky. You know, that didn't feel quite right. I don't know what's going on with that person. That's not necessarily a cue you would pick up on the phone.
You know, so you became a freelancer, Wade, at the network, but first you had to talk your way in the door, because while you were a graduate of the University of Texas, your degree was in history, as we've said, you had no journalism credits whatsoever. What did you say that got you in the door?
Well, I understood how power worked. I'd been working in politics for a long time, and so I had the ability to understand not just politics, but the power that is underneath politics. There's organized money and there's organized people. And the ways in which those two entities interact is kind of the key to understanding how the country works. And NPR was attracted by that idea. I mean, they could see I was not a kid. I'd been around the block quite a few times. I just didn't know what I was doing when it came to be a radio reporter. Mm-hmm. But that worked out okay for me, because since I didn't know any better, I just had to, like, tell the story like I would to my wife or my children or my friends at dinner, which is you start at the beginning and then you go through it until the end. And so pretty much all my stories are like that, but that was simply out of ignorance.
Are you, as you were trying to do this while living in New York, you were on a freelancer's pay. I'm guessing you figured out at some point that that wasn't a path to financial success, living in New York City, working at a freelancer's pay.
I did my first story. It appeared on WNYC, and I packed up and moved back to Austin, which is my hometown. It had been my plan. I knew I could never live in New York City on a freelancer's salary. So, when I was in Austin and I was first starting to do this, it would be 3 to 4 weeks. That's how long it would take me to do a single story. And slowly but surely, I got faster, learned how to log tape on a laptop that looked like a cinder block. and my big break, you know, every reporter needs a break, was the Branch Davidian siege.
That's my next question. Why was it a big break for you?
Because, I mean, no one had ever heard of me before. I'd been doing a story here, a story there, but then suddenly I was on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That siege lasted 57 days or 59 days, I can't remember, 2 months, and then continued afterwards.
Controversy, yeah.
And just, figuring out what had happened and why it had happened the way it did. So I stayed with that story for a long time, and it was after the Branch Davidian siege that NPR offered me my first contract.
And off you went.
And off I went. And then, the seeds of the Oklahoma City bombing were born in that Waco tragedy because Timothy McVeigh got so mad at what had happened to the Branch Davidians, he picked the same day that the compound burned down to blow up the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma, and it was absolutely payback against federal authorities for what had happened in Waco.
Has the image of the FBI ever recovered since the Branch Davidian controversy?
Well, it's certainly having a heck of a time these days.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I think it recovered. I mean, it changed the way the FBI handled these situations.
And it changed the way a lot of people looked at the FBI, Wade.
It did. But I remember going back at the first anniversary to the site of the compound. It was a tourist attraction then. I was doing one of these first anniversary stories. And the people I interviewed who were out there would say, well, I feel sorry for the children, but I don't feel sorry for the adults. And the reason was because they didn't come out. And it just felt like such a harsh response, that it was okay for all those people to die for believing in David and for not coming out when the FBI
told Koresh,
David Koresh, when the FBI told him to. And I really felt some responsibility for that.
I was going to say, you learned a big lesson from that story, at least you've said so.
I really bought the FBI's the way they depicted David Koresh. Jesus in a Trans Am was the headlines back then. And every day we went to the Coliseum and met with the FBI at 10 a.m. and kind of had our daily FBI feeding, but we could never talk to the Branch Davidians ever. And at first, it took me a while to realize I was kind of just reporting one side of the story. It was only when I began to talk with Baylor religion professors that they started to teach me about the Seventh-day Adventists, that each generation kind of believes they have their own prophet, that David was inside this tradition, and in fact that Koresh had some interesting insights into the Bible and the way certain parts of the Bible that were connected that they hadn't themselves seen before.
So the walkaway lesson for you was what?
Be careful about what you think you think. You've got to have some distance on your own head. You've got to have some distance on what you think about a story going in. And, that I learned that lesson in spades on that story. I mean, and I never, I was a young reporter, not young in age, but young in experience. And it taught me a lot about being skeptical of official sources.
Wade Goodwin is here. He's a NPR national correspondent based in Texas. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You don't shy away from these colorful phrases to help you describe what's going on. Gobsmacking amazement, or dozens of grasshoppers with antennas so large they look like antlers. Where do you find that stuff?
Mostly just in myself. I mean, The antlers was a grasshoppers with antlers was a story I was doing about a dispute with. It was a story about a rancher. It was a profile of a rancher, and it was an interesting story because you realize just how much his own man he was. I mean, the circumstances of his life were completely and totally under his control and had been his whole life. He answered to no one except, you know, himself, and and his, you know, he made whatever product he made with his cattle, and his farm were his. And he was such an interesting, but on the way to the farm, I was driving along this dirt road, and all of a sudden, these grasshoppers came flying up, and they were huge. I don't think I'd ever seen grasshoppers like that.
Little airplanes, right?
They were, and the mess they made, I mean, it took me, you know, I had to scrub the car like four times to get it off.
Do you come from a family of storytellers?
I do. My father was a great storyteller, and, you know, dinner time at our house was a time when we all got together, sat around the table, and talked about what was going on in the world and in our lives. And, you know, he was mesmerizing as a storyteller. I don't know why Southerners have this tradition of, you know, sitting on the back porch and having a beer and telling each other stories, but it's a rich tradition and it's a good way to do radio.
Your father was a man of considerable distinction.
He was a writer. He was a early organizer in the civil rights movement. He was an editor with the Texas Observer, and then became a professor at Duke for 30 years.
Wrote a book on populism.
He did. He wrote, if I do say so myself, a very fine book about the populist movement, which has a lot to do with Texas and Kansas.
Absolutely.
And you know, the Midwest. And, you know, it's amazing to think about the Farmers' Revolt and what it meant to the country at the time in the 1890s.
Howard from Overland Park. Howard, you're on with Wade Goodwin. Good morning.
Good morning. Wade, I want to congratulate you on the piece you did about the Dallas Homeless Singing Opera. That was an extraordinary piece.
Thank you very much.
I don't know if you got much response from them. Another thing is, there's something very extraordinary. All these things that are dear to America's heart, Yankees baseball, you'll find broadcasters of thick Southern accents, Red Barber from South Carolina, Mel Allen from Alabama, and the newscast journalists that are so important, Dan Rather from Texas, Edward R. Murray from North Carolina. What in the world is going on with all these people with really thick Southern accents being so close to America's heart and, you know, these important positions? So I think you get the gist of my question, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Howard.
Well, I do think it comes from this this generations of men and women who communicated, who spent their evenings talking to each other. The evening's entertainment was outside. The houses were hot. And so you stayed outside in the evenings on the porch, and people came by and they visited. And they shared stories with each other. And to be a talented raconteur was to be a very valued person. I mean, people would want to be with you because you would tell such funny and interesting stories. And I think that the traditions that have been passed down, I mean, that becomes a good way to talk about the news. And so I think the telling of stories in a variety of guises, and you could be a teacher and be a storyteller, and you can be a news person and be a storyteller. But I do think it's rooted in a Southern tradition of the way that we pass down to one another our histories.
What was the homeless opera story about?
There's a street choir in Dallas who this remarkable man named Jonathan Pallant who's one of the most talented artistic directors, choral directors in the country, decided he was going to put together a choir of homeless people. And he began bringing in some of the world's most famous operas and Broadway singers. And recently, I believe it was last year, for the first time ever, Carnegie Hall featured a choir, a performance by people, every one of them, was homeless. And some of the biggest stars on Broadway sang and performed with them.
Wow. Back to some calls. Caroline from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, and good morning to Wade. Wade, I just want to say thank you. I'm actually a longtime member of KCUR here, but I used to live for 3 decades in Dallas. I was a longtime KERA member. And that's when I first heard you. I still distinctly remember first hearing your stories about Waco, and especially about Oklahoma City, where I could remember sitting in my car and listening to this Wade Goodwin, and I just felt like I was there when you were telling the story and when you were interviewing people. So I just want to say thank you, and I'll take any comments off the air.
Well, that's very kind of you to say.
Not bad, Wayne.
KERA, yeah, no, it's a great station. You know, public radio is undergoing a renaissance. Renaissance is not the word. It's undergoing a explosion of expansion. Texas now has a Texas state network where all of the stations create a news program, daily news program that all of the stations' reporters contribute to. And I think it and some other states, of course, Minnesota, California, New York, Massachusetts, it's a growing phenomenon. And what we're trying to do is try to fill this space, this vacuum that is being created by the destruction of newspapers and print journalism. And it is vitally important to the future of our country. People like yourself who are members of these stations or who volunteer, who give money, you are critical to making this happen because that's who pays my salary.
And who would have thought 20 years ago, that radio would be the thing that survives this media upheaval we're experiencing?
Yes. I mean, we have an ever-growing captive audience who are sitting in their cars on their way to work, on their way home. They're stuck in traffic, and they don't want to listen to the same songs over and over again. And so they you know, find NPR, and then that becomes, I have people who come, there's two reactions. One is people will say, I'm sorry, what station did you say you work for? Mm-hmm. Or people say, I have only one station on my car dial,
yes,
and that's
NPR.
And you know, don't worry about it, someone's head getting too big, because 3/4 of the time people say, I'm sorry, what station did you say you work for? But there is we have a growing, a devoted audience. They use us as their first source of news. And, in this day and age, I think it's important that we have independent journalism that knows how to hold power accountable.
You know, so much of the work you've done, Wade, has centered on not just violence, but extreme violence. You know, the Dallas police shootings, the Oklahoma City bombing, the Texas church massacre from last fall, hurricanes, tornadoes. How much of a toll does that take on you?
It takes a toll. I mean, I am hurricaned out. I'll tell you a quick story. So you're driving, you've been assigned, and you're going to where you've been put into place, and you're on the highway, and you're driving down to wherever you're going, Galveston or Corpus Christi or Louisiana, you're the only one practically on this side of the highway. Everybody else is on the other side of the highway. It's jam-packed, and it's mile after mile after mile of people just sitting there trying to get away. And you're going 75 because there's no one going where you're going. Everyone's trying to get away from where you're going. It gives you a feeling of uneasiness. And then you get to where you're going, and everything is perfectly fine. It's all beautiful. It's all great. But you know, in 24 hours, this place is going to look like an atomic bomb hit it.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you feel sad because you've already, you've done the before and after. And then covering it, it's like, it's kind of like being a war correspondent in Vietnam. You know, these always happen in the summertime. You lose the electricity. So it's hot. You know, everything's destroyed. A lot of times you're walking across the lobby of a hotel and it's covered with glass because all the windows have blown in. And like here's a few hurricane tricks. You know what you need to do? You need to fill up the tub with water, because you're going to have to use the water in the tub and the ice bucket in order to flush the toilet. Because there is no more power to flush right. the toilet. And it's those kinds of the idea that you're going to have to go, you know, spend another week in these kinds of places. It really is tough. And that's just hurricanes. I could go on and on about school shootings are a nightmare to cover. You know, you go into a town that's had a school shooting and they feel terribly guilty about it, even though there is absolutely no reason for them to do so. And all they want you to do is get away and get out of mm-hmm. there, because you're making them feel even worse about something they feel bad enough. And so there's a lot of the violent stories are hard to cover.
That's NPR's Wade Goodwin, who's in town doing some events for KCUR today and tomorrow. And Wade, what a pleasure to have you here. So nice to meet you. And congratulations on all the good work you've done. We sure appreciate it.
No, the pleasure was all mine.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to switch topics and talk with an actor who does one-man shows portraying Hitler, Dickens, Casanova, Churchill, and did I mention Margaret Thatcher? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, we'll go over Governor Eric Greitens' proposed state budget that he's trotting out today with the Missouri Budget Project, and we'll try to find out what the document says about his priorities for the government. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, how about an actor who, in a series of one-man shows, portrays Hitler, Dickens, Casanova, Churchill, and also Margaret Thatcher? And Pip Utton didn't even begin acting until he was 45. In the years since, he's earned rave reviews across the pond, and he'll be in Kansas City this week performing an array of his characters. Pip, welcome. So good to have you here.
It's good to be here as well, Steve.
I mean, really, Hitler, Dickens, Casanova, Churchill, and Thatcher? What were
yes.
you thinking?
I needed the work. I mean, they're all interesting characters, and they're all...
Yes, they are.
And they're none of them, on a very basic level, they're none of them very attractive physically characters, so I can play them.
That works for your mug, eh?
Yeah, for my face. My rubber face can cope with unattractive faces, yeah.
You know, I know you get asked this all the time, but the obvious question, who do you enjoy playing the most, and who's the most challenging?
The most challenging is Margaret Thatcher,
mm.
Because of the nature of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the show, the audience get to ask Margaret Thatcher questions,
and you're improvising your responses.
Yes,
yeah.
So I'm constantly researching that one. So that's probably the most challenging. That I enjoy playing Bacon, Francis Bacon.
Francis Bacon,
because I get to drink a bottle of champagne through the show, which is
it's not a real bottle of champagne.
Yes.
Oh no!
Yeah. It's
you drink the real stuff.
Method acting, but it's really most basic. Yes,
you're not you're not fooling anybody out there. You're doing the real thing.
It's the real thing. Yes, yeah, it's not fake stuff. No.
Yeah, why did I assume just it would be? Of course it is, but you're saying no.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. Well, it's probably not good practice. I wouldn't do it for every part.
Yeah.
But I don't think it matters. This, he's supposed to get drunk. And he's supposed to rave and rant and be outrageous. So why not?
You do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what made you think you could portray all these different characters? There's a certain confidence you're displaying there, I guess.
Yes, or arrogance, perhaps.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's because most of these characters have become two-dimensional now in mm-hmm. people's memories.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want to do is try and make them three-dimensional again. To make them real people. So I'm not doing a cartoon spitting image or Saturday Night Live send-up.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to do is actually, I know this sounds very crass in a way, I'm actually trying to be them.
Mm-hmm. So when you walk away from the Dickens, like the Dickens character really fascinates me just because of who he was and how much he wrote before computers, obviously, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So what do you walk away from a Charles Dickens event?
When I walk away from Charles Dickens, I mean, Dickens is my favourite writer. I think Dickens was a greater writer of English even than Shakespeare, possibly. Mm. And to be able to inhabit Dickens' personality and read some of his works out loud as he performed them is not just a pleasure, but it's an honour and also a responsibility to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what I do with Dickens is, I don't know if you've seen a lot of one-man shows, what they tend to have is somebody who's dead comes back to life, or somebody just dies, or mm-hmm. it's a very, very simple mechanical way of getting from A to Z. But I let Dickens die right at the beginning.
Yeah, you actually come on the stage and you die.
I come on the stage and drop dead.
Why do you do that?
And then I leap up and I say, right, we've got that over with now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now we're going to talk about who I am.
Yeah. We don't have to go through all that wasted time of me pretending to die and coughing and spluttering. You know, just forget it.
How much do we know about who Charles Dickens, what he really was like?
We know quite a lot. I mean, there's a lot of his life is quite accurately recorded. But there are gaps in it. And, of course, in those days, it was easier to keep secrets. He managed to keep his mistress secret for almost his whole lifetime, for perhaps 12 years, kept her secret. And he did like young ladies, without any doubt at all. But that was all very, very secret as well. But then there weren't the investigative journalists, and of course, nobody recognised him. He could walk through the street outside of London and not be recognised, because there was no television, there was no photography was in its infancy. So people, unless they came to see him and hear him read his works, they had no idea what he looked like.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Pip Udden will be performing his one-man shows at the Central Standard Theatre from February 1st to 4th, so later on this week. On the 1st, he plays Margaret Thatcher. On the 2nd, Francis Bacon. On the 3rd and 4th, Churchill. And also on the 3rd and 4th, Adolf Hitler. For tickets and more information, go to Central Standard Theatre, Kansas City's website. You can just find it by plugging that into Google. Adolf Hitler has been your big breakthrough role.
Yeah. That's my greatest hit.
Why?
It's because it's so very different,
mm-hmm.
and it challenges the audience in a way that theatre doesn't always challenge the audience.
In what sense?
There is a big twist that I won't tell you what it is,
sure.
But there is a big twist in it that makes the audience, when it works, and I hope it works every time, makes the audience think, what's going on now? What am I watching? No, he can't say that. He shouldn't. Oh yeah, no, I agree with that, and it's a big turnaround on the audience.
Is it based on your own research of him and who he was?
No, it's that bit is based on my feelings about politicians today, and in it contains quotes from Bill Clinton, from Kennedy, from Kofi Annan, Tony Blair, Margaret Thatcher, but they're all put into the mouth of either Adolf Hitler or the other person that appears in the play.
How challenging is it to draw an audience for a one-man show about Hitler?
Well, I'm not sure what it's like in the States, but still in Europe, if TV's put on a series about the Second World War, people watch it. We're still fascinated by the whole thing, how it happened, why it happened, and how eventually the underdogs won after Russia and America joined in.
It wasn't that long ago.
And it wasn't that long ago. And they have become the symbol of evil. Adolf Hitler and his henchmen have become the symbol of evil, probably the biggest symbol of evil of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So we're fascinated by it. And so people will come to see it. Because this addresses, it's not just about the Holocaust, or it's not just about his triumphs, but it's actually trying to look at how he managed to persuade an educated nation, a proud nation like Germany, to follow him and worship him. And they were devoted to him.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, how can somebody who stands there saying these things, how can that happen? So that's what it explores.
And the audience reacts to your portrayal of Hitler how?
The portrayal of Hitler is very accurate and is thoroughly researched, and so it's nothing they haven't seen before, and other people do.
Didn't I read that someone in one of your audiences reached up and smacked you one right across the face for what was going on there?
Yeah.
What happened there?
I wound her up. I wound the whole audience up. I take the wig off and I take the moustache off. And it looks as if the show's finished. But it hasn't. And there's a ride that I take the audience on, which isn't a comfortable ride. And it's challenging for me because every actor wants to be loved.
Yeah.
And I probably spend most of that time being hated by the audience.
You know, you were, Pip, you were in your mid-40s, I want to say 45, working as a jeweler.
Yep.
And suddenly, you weren't working in that job anymore. You were off on an idea, a dream of being an actor. That's a tough age to make a transition to a profession that's as shaky as professional acting. What were you thinking?
That it was time to chase the dream.
Be too late.
Or it would be too late. And I didn't want to get to the age I am now and think, well, you know, what I should have done 20 years ago is tried and made an attempt. And I was fed up of being a jeweler. I'd been doing it for the best part of 30 years. It was time to make a change, time for a challenge. And you're right, it's a tough, tough profession, and they didn't want me. And I ended up having to write my own work and stage my own work, and I've been very, very fortunate. It's now taken me all over the world and continues to do so. So this is my second visit to Kansas City, and it's nice to be back. And when I get back, I go up for a month into the Netherlands, and then I'm off to Norway, and then later in the year to Poland and to South Africa. So
the world has opened up.
Wonderfully. I'm having such a wonderful experience. And meeting and working with such truly lovely people.
What were you naive about when you made the transition from your career as a jeweler to acting? What slapped you across the face?
I thought that I really did think that I would become an instant success, that everybody was waiting for me to join the profession.
We're all waiting for that, yeah.
Yeah, and they weren't. And I was very lucky. I had a play that I was in and got very good reviews and an agent. And I thought, that's it. I've made it. And for the next 18 months, the phone didn't ring at all. And I did think that I was the best thing since Derek Jacobi or since Robert De Niro or any of those greats. And
well, you've got to think that, don't you?
You have, but then you've got to be realistic. Mm-hmm. And you ain't going to be the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been fortunate in finding what I can do.
Just a final thing here. You also portray Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
A woman, obviously.
Yes.
You're not a woman.
No.
Why did you want to portray Margaret Thatcher, and how do you do that as a male?
I wanted a challenge. It's very easy. Margaret Thatcher was a very divisive politician.
Yes.
And it's very, very, she's the sort of politician it's very easy to take the mickey out of. You can really make fun out of her in a very cheap way. You just mock the voice. You can mock the way she spoke. You can mock the way she dressed and looked. And I didn't want to do that. Again, it goes back, I wanted to be her. Not an apology for her.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want her to explain away what she's done. And I wanted to challenge people. Again, to put your mouth where your money is. Don't just moan about her in the bar beforehand. Come inside and ask her. Tell her what you think about her.
But you thought you could do her.
Yes.
Even though she's a woman. Do you speak like her?
Well, actually, it's not that difficult.
Okay. Yeah. That's all there is to it. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I can't do it, no. Pip Utton, again, performs his one-man shows at the Central Standard Theater beginning on the 1st of February until the 4th. On the 1st, it's playing Margaret Thatcher, and the 2nd, Francis Bacon. The 3rd and 4th, he'll be doing shows featuring both Winston Churchill and Adolf Hitler. For tickets, go to the Central Standard Theater Kansas City website. And Pip, so great to meet you. Good luck with your voyage here.
Thank you very much for your time.
Coming up, Greg Eklund and his sports report. Thank you. Royals fans know that spring training is just around the corner, and some of the most diehard of those fans were at FanFest this weekend. Here to fill us in on some off-season developments is KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund. And Greg, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve. Welcome to you, as always, on a Monday.
There were a few big stories to emerge out of FanFest over the weekend. The first involved an unceremonious fall that Ned Yost took during the offseason. Of course, we're talking about the Royals manager.
A very serious situation His life was threatened falling off that deer stand on his farm in Georgia. And he was laid up for quite a while. And Dayton Moore admitted that he didn't know if Ned Yost was going to be able to return as manager if he had first and foremost lived through this, but he got immediate aid and has been recovering. He's still not fully recovered, but
I was gonna say, how do you look?
Recovered enough, and if you looked at him, you would not have known that he went through what he had gone through. When he turned his head, he looked a little stiff when he turned his head or his shoulder because of the injuries in the pelvic region. But, he looked pretty good for what he has been through.
And he says he's ready to go.
He says he's ready to go. Now, whether the team is ready to go, that's another question, because I'm not sure if Ned Yost even knows who he's going to be putting out on the field or in the lineup.
Well, we don't know. There's been some developments in the last few days involving the fates of Elcides Escobar and Lorenzo Cain. What do we know there?
Well, the major news with Lorenzo Cain came out late last week when it was announced that he had signed with the Milwaukee Brewers, the organization that he actually started with before he was traded to the Royals.
He got a terrific contract.
He did. 5 years, $90 million for a guy in his early 30s. That's a very good contract. And the Royals, quite frankly, are very happy for him because they know what he meant to this organization. But they know that they were not going to be paying that kind of money over the long haul for Lorenzo Cain.
Well, different topic. Today is Kansas. Well, before I forget, Hosmer, what do we know?
Well, we don't know anything. Everything is on hold. And it's not
just
Hosmer. Moustakas, J.D. Martinez, Yu Darvish. One of the most bizarre free agent seasons in the offseason that I could recall.
Is there a chance we get both Hosmer and Moustakas back again?
If to borrow the saying, yeah, there's a chance. I don't think that we'll see both of them. With the crazy things that have gone on in the offseason, though, I can't rule anything out.
Okay, now let's move on. Today is Kansas Day. Happy Kansas Day.
Which is the most appropriate time for a
K-State-KU basketball game, which will be tonight. I understand you'll be in Manhattan for the game. What are you going to be watching for?
I'm going to be watching if the game is close, if Kansas State is going to foul Udoka Azubuike.
No kidding, which worked out pretty well.
Worked out great for Oklahoma last week. Listen to this line. This was Matt Freeman, who came off the bench for Oklahoma last week. He played 2 minutes, and he had 5 fouls, which disqualified him from the game. He left the game.
On the KU center.
Exactly. He put him at the line. He couldn't make his free throws. Oklahoma took advantage. KU lost the game, and Bill Self, in retrospect, says he probably should have taken him out of the game.
Well, why wouldn't any team begin a game by fouling him and allowing your team to build a lead over the vaunted KU Jayhawks?
Well, I mean, KU was in control in the second half. They had taken over in the second half. Then all of a sudden, Oklahoma used that strategy before KU even got into its offense. You put the guy at the line, he misses the free throws, Oklahoma gets the rebound, and then they have possession.
Well, why not start a game, even bringing in one of your reserves, just have them foul him to start the game 4 or 5 times and give your team a chance to build a lead?
Well, maybe we'll see that tonight.
Man, that's amazing.
That's revolutionary thinking there, Steve.
Well, I'm always ahead of the most college coaches, even though I don't get paid like a champ. Okay, you say the women's basketball game of the year is this week in Columbia. Fill us in on that.
Wednesday night, the Mizzou Tigers, the women are rated 11th in the nation, coming off a tough loss yesterday at South Carolina, but this Wednesday is the game of the year in Columbia when Mississippi State comes in. Mississippi State was the NCAA runner-up last year. In the semifinals last year, historically ended the UConn run to the championship, And South Carolina actually ended up beating Mississippi State in an all-SEC final for the championship. But this season, Mississippi State is one of two undefeated teams in women's college basketball. UConn is the other, to no surprise. And they're ranked number two. It should be a great matchup coming in into Columbia this Wednesday.
This Wednesday, okay. Switching to the Mizzou men's team, there have been some unwelcome developments around the status of Terrence Phillips. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that news came out on Friday night, and since then the news has come out from both the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the Kansas City Star that the Title IX office is investigating that situation. Terrence Phillips is a reserve guard. He's not one of Konzo Martin's recruits. He was actually with the team for a couple of years before this season. He's on indefinite suspension, and if a Title IX investigation is underway, it means that there's an issue possibly of perhaps sexual violence, maybe harassment, maybe discrimination.
Huh, okay. On Friday evening, Mizzou also announced they fired a very successful softball coach. Mm. What happened?
Funny how bad news always comes out on Friday night.
what is that about?
Well, Aaron Earlywine, he's been a controversial figure at Mizzou for the way he handles his players. A lot of players have left the program, but the surprise about this is the timing of it. The MU softball team opens its season on February 8th in Tempe. If they didn't want Earlywine around, why didn't they do this at a much earlier time to give themselves at least more time to prepare for the season? But the announcement came out on Friday, and Earlywine is gone.
You don't expect the Royals to compete for the Central Division Championship this year, do you?
Well, we don't know what they have. How can you even say whether they'll compete when we don't know what they have? So are we basing it on them not having Moustakas and Hosmer? If so, you would be hard-pressed to say that they'd be contenders. They have some young talent that they'll be infusing into the lineup. But, you know, there were 15,000 fans who attended the Fan Fest over the weekend, which was down. The peak years of the World Series years had about 20,000 plus.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those fans, I'm sure, went in with the same feeling that you and I have. There's so much uncertainty around this team, we just don't know.
That's KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund. Greg, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
Tune in tomorrow for a closer look at Governor Greitens' proposed budget for Missouri with the Missouri Budget Project. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.